Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 11 cities and towns across Massachusetts are holding their preliminary elections today, and there are some fascinating races. From the four women running to be the first female mayor of North Adams to the first district-level city council elections ever in Lowell, the community's voting run the gamut, big to small, urban to rural, and the candidates reflect that range and diversity. WBUR's Simone Rios is reporting on them today, joins us now. Simone, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to start in Lawrence, Simone. I think it is fascinating. Technically an open seat, Mayor Dan Rivera stepped down in January to head up Mass Development. After 7 years leading the city, he was really visible after the Merrimack Valley gas explosion during a school turnaround there, underscoring just how important a mayor can be. And now we've got acting Mayor Kendris Vasquez trying to win a full term against four challengers, including, wait for it, another former mayor. So, Simone, wow. And what are the big issues shaping the race there?
Yeah, you know, talking to people in Lawrence, it seems like issues that can resonate with people in cities across Massachusetts. You know, first is the pandemic. Like other gateway cities, Lawrence has been hit really hard by the coronavirus. Then, of course, people are concerned about the lack of housing in the city. I talked to a city councilor who told me that because of gentrification happening and displacement in neighboring cities, rents that were just $800 2 years ago are now in the $1,300, $1,400 range.
Ouch.
Public safety is another concern in the city. Some advocates say the Lawrence police need to have greater sensitivity to the mental health issues facing residents by adding staff with that kind of training. And you have an interesting slate of candidates hoping to take on these issues as mayor.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that. You've got this unusual acting mayor versus former mayor. Tell us about those two candidates and how they are trying to contrast themselves, their visions for leadership, et cetera.
Yeah, so Kendris Vasquez is the current acting mayor. He was city council president when former mayor Daniel Rivera left office in December to head Mass Development. Vasquez has touted the creation of a foreclosure ordinance, as well as his efforts to get people in Lawrence vaccinated. Then you have the return of William Lantigua. He was the first Hispanic mayor in Massachusetts, and his years in office were really mired in controversy. Lantigua was a state rep and ran unsuccessfully against Mayor Rivera. He recently worked for the U.S. Census, and he's still hoping he can make a political comeback in Lawrence. Another candidate, I should say, is a well-known activist in the city, Brian De Peña. He owns two small automotive businesses in Lawrence, and he served on the city council for a number of years. My understanding is that Peña is actually expected to make it to second place, second to Kendris Vasquez, to get into the general election in November. And finally, you have two female candidates running in Vilma Martinez Dominguez and Doris Rodriguez. They're both lesser known public servants trying to make a splash in Lawrence politics.
Well, that is going to be so interesting to watch. Let's leave Lawrence now and let's travel over to North Adams, where four women are vying to be the city's first female mayor. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Mayor Thomas Bernard announced he wasn't going to run for re-election, and the four people who stood up to replace him are all women. And that'll be the first mayor who's female, as you noted, in North Adams history. So to go through the candidates, you have Lynette Ritlin Bond. She sits on the city's planning board and works at the Mass College of Liberal Arts. She cites the city's aging infrastructure as a priority, which seems to be a common theme in North Adams. Another candidate is Rachel Branch, a third-time candidate for mayor. She runs a TV show on community television there. She says climate change is one of the key issues she wants to address. Jennifer Maxey is an official at the North Berkshire School Union. Earlier in her career, she was the city treasurer in North Adams, as well as tax collector. And then finally, April Lynn Carsnow, she's a healthcare worker who's currently working at a grocery store in North Adams.
And top two there as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh. All right. So now let's head back over to Lowell, because that one is a first, right? Electing district level councilors for the first time in history. How did that happen?
Yeah, this is really fascinating. Lowell was one of these cities that had all at-large city council and school committee positions, and advocates in the city, which at the time of the lawsuit, almost 50% of the population were people of color, Hispanics and Asians primarily. They were arguing that the at-large system was illegally diluting the voting power of minority voters in the city, and that that was a violation of the Voting Rights Act. Iván Espinosa Madrigal of Lawyers for Civil Rights, which was the organization that brought the case, he says people of color barely had any representation in elected office before the case came down.
And this consistently meant that the candidates in communities of color would face significant barriers and obstacles to getting elected.
And so in 2019, that lawsuit was successful. And in 2019, a new model was approved by the voters of Lowell that will hopefully allow for greater representation in the city's politics. So the city council will expand from 9 to 11 members with 8 district seats. Remember, there were no district seats.
Right.
It was all at large. And then 3 at-large seats will remain. So it's a hybrid model. And then the school committee will have 4 district seats and 2 at large.
That is one we should come back and check on. That's going to be interesting to watch. So now let's go down to Fall River. Paul Coogan, who replaced now convicted and sentenced felon Jaisal Correa, is the city's mayor, is trying to win another term. But I understand he's facing a strong challenge.
Yes, City Council President Cliff Ponte is the key challenger. Ponte, you'll recall, took over when Jaisal Correa was pushed out. CJ Ferry is a political observer I check in with, also a one-time candidate in Fall River. I asked who he's voting for, and he just laughed and said the other guy without specifying who. He's not crazy about either candidate. In Ponte's case, because of a memo that leaked where Ponte indicated that he would only be a part-time mayor, that it was a ceremonial position to be mayor in Fall River, and he'd continue running his real estate business. I guess he's since backtracked on that sentiment. And Ferry's not crazy about Coogan either, because he says he's failed to unite the city after Correa went down or come up with a cohesive plan for Fall River's future. Let's hear from CJ Ferry.
I'm expecting a less than 15% turnout, because there's no city council race, there's no school committee race. People already know who's gonna come out as the top two.
That would be a low turnout. I mean, low turnout, Simone. 25% in Boston, and people were concerned that wasn't very big. So does the legacy of Correa continue to impact the race?
Absolutely. I mean, look what happened today. He was sentenced for his role in extorting cannabis companies trying to set up shop in Fall River. 6 years in prison, and we're talking about it right now. And the two people running were two of Correa's top opponents, who really stood to gain the most from the end of Jaisal Correa's political career for now.
And I just want to point out that Correa actually had been recalled and reelected at one point. So there have been a number of races where he was kind of up for it, then put out. But then after he was reelected after being recalled, then he lost handily the last time he ran to Coogan, correct?
Right. Another case for ranked choice voting, because Correa was able to squeak by when a number of other candidates were on the ballot. But when it was a face-to-face challenge with Paul Coogan, Coogan was able to win.
Okay. And just briefly, Simone, what do you think is at stake for Fall River here?
There's always a lot at stake in Fall River elections, and I don't know if this election will change anything, but let's listen again to CJ Ferry on this question.
We've had 6 years of turmoil under Jaisal Correa, and that turmoil we still need to recover from.
And ironically, when I was talking to Mr. Ferry earlier, he was watching the sentencing the second day of Jaisal Correa's sentencing, and now we know that just a few minutes ago he was sentenced to 6 years in prison.
6 years of turmoil and then 6 years in prison. That's WBUR reporter Simone Rios. Simone, thanks.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
So let's talk now about that pair of 6 years. Sticking with Fall River, as Simone said, just before 3 o'clock, former Mayor Jaisal Correa was sentenced to 6 years in prison for charges of corruption. Now, we were expecting the sentence at a hearing yesterday. Instead, Judge Douglas Woodlock shocked those inside and out of the courtroom by overturning 8 of Correa's 21 convictions from the jury. Tim White has been following the case from the start, joins us. He is a reporter with WPRI in Rhode Island. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Tiziana, pleasure to be here.
Busy afternoon, Tim. Breaking sure news, yeah, on the sentence. So what can you tell us?
Well, as you pointed out, Jaisal Correa, the former mayor of Fall River, was sentenced to 6 years in prison by Judge Douglas Woodlock. And the thrust of the case against Jaisal really did boil down to the shaking down of those businesses that looked to open up marijuana shops in Fall River. This was almost certainly a much lighter sentence than he would have received if yesterday hadn't happened. As you pointed out, the judge dismissed 8 counts against Jaisal Correa. And a thing to keep in mind here, Tiziana, is that when a judge is considering a sentence for a defendant, they turn to the U.S. Probation Office, their sentencing guidelines. And, you know, the probation office looks at a number of factors, including the number of victims, the seriousness of the crime. But a big one is the monetary value of the crime at hand. And by dismissing those 8 counts, that lowered the monetary value of the crimes that Correa was initially convicted of by a jury. And so it is likely it definitely lowered the sentencing guidelines. And that's the compass that the judge uses to generate the sentence. And so it was likely much lower.
Yeah, just to put it in perspective, prior to yesterday, prosecution was asking for 11 years, I believe. The defense was asking for 3. So here we are at 6. So a couple quick sort of rapid fire questions. First, did the judge overturn any more of the convictions today, or was yesterday it?
It appears yesterday was it, and I'm couching it a little bit because it was considering 2 other tax evasion, filing a false tax return counts. He had dismissed 6 wire fraud counts and 2 tax counts yesterday. There was a lot of debate over 2 other tax counts, but it appears the judge let those stand by sentencing him without formally dismissing those. But we could see something appear on the docket later today.
Okay, and I understand that this is in flux, like we're learning as we go. To the best of your knowledge, is 6 years towards the upper end of the sentencing that was available or towards the lower end?
Much lower, actually, Tiziana. One of the things that sort of surprised me here is the sentencing guidelines, even with the counts being dismissed, put Correa at north of 12 years, if I did my math right on the back of my notepad. And so even the prosecution was asking for less than what the guideline range called for. But, you know, it is a judge's discretion, and a judge can do more or less than the U.S. Probation Office puts forward in their guideline range. And real quick, he decided to look at other public corruption cases that have come before the federal court, particularly in Boston in the last few years. And I think that was his barometer when he was trying to determine the sentence.
All right, let's take a time out for a minute from this last hour, which is where we've been focusing. And let's go back years, because it's been years that this story has unfolded. It's a heck of a story. We got to a point where he was charged with wire fraud, filing false tax returns, extortion. How did we get here? What's the Correa story in a nutshell?
Well, he was the youngest mayor ever to be elected in Fall River history, just 23 years old back in 2015. He won a second term in 2017. And even then, when he got into office, there was a lot of turmoil with the 2 mayors prior to him when he was on the city council, a Mayor Flanagan. So there's been a political disturbance in the force, if you will, in Fall River for quite some time. He was first charged in 2018, and that case was entirely, Tiziana, on the accusations that he embezzled money from a app that he was developing called Snow Owl. He was able to lure a bunch of investors, but what the government said was instead of using that money to better the company, he was fueling a lavish lifestyle. After he was indicted and charged in that case, the FBI investigation continued, And they then filed a superseding indictment. They charged him again, arrested him again in 2019, almost a year later, and charged him in the case, the extortion case, accepting bribes from companies that were looking to open marijuana shops in Fall River. And because of the pandemic, Tiziana, this, you know, federal cases go much faster than state cases generally, but that wasn't the case here. They had to keep delaying this trial multiple times until ultimately in April there was a trial, and then in May there was a verdict. So when you step back and look at this at 30,000 feet, this has been hanging like a cloud over the city of Fall River for years. You can even stretch back to 2015 when he was first elected. That's 6 years that a lot of this has been going on. And it's really amazing.
And so it's really kind of a racking and stacking, right? First, you get a set of charges around his private activities with the app. Then you get a set of charges around extortion as mayor. And I'll come back to sort of the complexity of host community agreements where you have to get approval from the city to open a marijuana business. But you get these stacked. And my understanding is it's those that really stuck, Tim, right? The charges against him as mayor.
Yeah, so the government said that Correa put those host community agreements up for sale, and he sold the public's trust when he did that. And he was, you know, you need these letters, as you kind of intimated there. You need these letters if you're going to open up a business. At the time, the way it worked is any city or town, if you wanted to open up a marijuana business, you needed the okay from leadership in that city or town. And in this case, it was the mayor saying, we won't oppose. Here's a letter that we won't oppose you opening up a marijuana business in our community. And the government says Correa put those up for sale. Those, as you point out, are the counts that stood. And I would say those are the most damning counts, because that is the one where it erodes the public trust. That is, you know, this is a white collar crime case. It's a public corruption case. And that's the extortion accounts were the ones that were really the thrust of that.
All right. So we've covered a number of times here on this show, Tim, the critics of host community agreements, saying that the communities have a ton of leverage. It kind of opens the door for soft, or in this case, hard extortion. I know businesses and the sort of the cannabis policy community have been watching this. Mm-hmm. Do we think this will change anything? Do we know who's watching how this sentencing comes down?
Oh, yeah. I think that this is a case that is being watched very closely in that community. I mean, I recall the U.S. attorney at the time when these charges and this indictment came down, particularly the extortion one. The U.S. attorney said at a news conference at the time that when you have a setup like this, it is just ripe for corruption. It could happen in Fall River. It could happen in other communities. So absolutely, this sort of process and system fell immediately under scrutiny.
Yeah, Andrew Lelling was the person.
That's
you were.
The name.
Yeah,
thank you.
No problem. All right. So listen, before I let you go, you're at WPRI. You're in Rhode Island, but you have been deep on this, and you've really gotten to know Fall River through this reporting. They're in a preliminary election today. How do you think this is resonating there today? And how do you think the tale, the echo of this is going to resonate there?
You know, I never like to predict how a voter is feeling. But when you talk to the voters in Fall River, you know, one of the main things that's going on there right now is the police department is under scrutiny. It's a whole other, we could do a whole other segment on it, Tiziana, but it was basically some mishandling of evidence. And a lot of Mayor Coogan's critics are taking aim at him for that. So I think, you know, that is probably more front and center on voters' minds here when they're going to the ballot box than Mayor Jaisal Correa. But as I said earlier, it is, I think, a chapter that the people in Fall River just desperately want to move on from, because it's been sticking around for so long.
All right, Tim White, investigative reporter for WPRI in Rhode Island. Hey, thanks for joining the show. Really appreciate it today.
My pleasure.
Most of us are not strangers to spam calls, like for that warranty on the car you don't own or the student loans you never borrowed. But in many states, including in the Commonwealth, you should consider picking up calls from that unknown number, because it might actually be a contact tracer. You see, when anyone tests positive for COVID-19, teams of tracers are in charge of identifying every close contact they may have had with another human, calling that other human, informing them of their exposure, and encouraging them to get tested. And if they test positive, then the process repeats. But contact tracing is also about providing support for people during a potentially scary and unknown time. Earlier today, we spoke with Alexander Bent about this process. He is an investigator with the Massachusetts Community Tracing Collaborative. That's the contact tracing team with Partners in Health. Alex has been a contact tracer since last November, after he got laid off from another job because of the pandemic. And I asked him what it takes to do the role and what his days look like.
What we do is we just work from a queue. Anyone who's recently tested positive for COVID, they enter that queue. So we go in, we select a record, and we pick it up. That is an individual in Massachusetts somewhere in the state that tested positive. And at that point in time, what we try to do is reach out to them. So we have various surge phases depending on how many cases we're seeing on a daily basis within Massachusetts. So sometimes the amount of calls that we make to an individual can change. So currently we're just making one call to people to see if they'll pick up and hopefully speak with us.
So how often do they pick up, Alex?
Most often people do pick up with us. They're interested in speaking with us, giving us their close contacts, talking about exposure. And then, of course, on the other side of things, we have things that we can assist them with as well. So if they don't have the ability to stay in isolation or quarantine for the entire period because maybe they don't have enough food, for example, that's something we can assist them with as well.
So you call me, I pick up. How does that start?
Big first thing that we have to do there is obviously identify ourselves. A lot of these individuals don't realize that they are going to be receiving this call and that the state of Massachusetts even has this program. Because a lot of times what we can experience, at least on my end, is some people are hesitant to speak with us initially because they don't fully understand who we are or think that it might be a scam call, for example, which I totally understand.
And what do you tell them you want to speak with them about?
What we really just let them know is we'd like to discuss a few things related to their COVID test result with them. We do also importantly point out right at the beginning that we can assist with quite a few things like food, medication, et cetera, if individuals need that. So that's something that can help people want to speak with us much more quickly.
Do people get anxious about the government contacting them, Alex, asking for identity information, knowing about their health status? Are people mostly grateful? Are they afraid? How do people experience it when you reach out to them?
So we have individuals who are relieved to get that call from us because they have questions that they want answered and they know we can help them with that. We have other people that are initially hesitant to do it, but they can open up over time once they realize what we're doing. And then we do, of course, have those individuals that are really hesitant or even scared to speak with us because they don't know what's going to happen with that information. And they might have misconceptions that we're going to share that information with someone who can utilize that information to get them in trouble for something. What we do is we really just try to create that trust over the first couple minutes of that phone call and let them understand that really what we're trying to do is just at the end of the day, stop the spread of COVID. We're trying to understand where you might have been exposed. If you have any close contacts, we can just reach out to those individuals or businesses to let them know what happened there.
And can you tell us about a conversation you've had with someone who was unvaccinated and tested positive? Tell us about a person.
Yeah, so to kind of just talk in general terms, in recent memory, we have had quite a few individuals who are younger, fully healthy come in that are unfortunately unvaccinated. What we're seeing in recent memory is a lot of these individuals, they are experiencing a lot worse symptoms, including some people that, like I said, are young and overall healthy that do need to go to the ER or even urgent care because they're experiencing so many symptoms and are worried about what's going on with them. So what we are seeing a lot of times now is I've spoken with a few individuals recently who are unvaccinated and who have tested positive. And what they've learned throughout this experience is that they had wished that they had been vaccinated prior to testing positive. And as soon as they were possibly able to do so, they were going to go get vaccinated once they exited isolation because they didn't want to deal or experience this again.
So, Alex, you're clearly a professional and you're very straightforward and matter of fact about this. Thinking about the fear and the risk that can be associated and the harm that can be associated with having COVID. And I wonder, do you find yourself being called on to express a lot of empathy, to hold people's hands sometimes, to really comfort and reassure them as you're having this back and forth with them?
I think those are kind of a few of the key components that a person needs to do this job. Empathy is really important because not everyone you call is initially going to be interested in speaking with you or ever really want to talk to you. But regardless, you need to be empathetic through that entire conversation and the callbacks with that individual, because at the end of the day, you don't know exactly what they're going through or what they're dealing with. So it's important just to always be empathetic and kind of just approach every call that you make as just a human being, understanding that you don't exactly know what these individuals are going through, but you're there to support them however you can.
And what do you think people need to hear from you in those moments?
Honestly, a lot of times just those individuals knowing that they have someone there that can support them, that will give them calls back as frequently as a daily basis, just a touch point with them, make sure that they're doing okay, and even give them a social outlet.
Do you do that? Do you call people back day after day and check in with them?
Generally speaking, if we're not in a surge phase, we do try to call people back regularly, like every day or every other day or every couple days, just to check with them, see how they're doing, and give them that social outlet so they have someone to speak with throughout their isolation and quarantine period.
Alex, what's your favorite part of the job?
I just like helping individuals through this process. I can only imagine being on the other side of this. I'm really well trained and educated in COVID and Corona at this point in time. But prior to joining the CTC organization, I knew minimal stuff about this. So just kind of putting myself in the shoes of the person on the other side and understanding that they might not really know what's going on here, might not have the support to get themselves through that or even need assistance to get themselves through that. I kind of just like approaching it in that way.
Anything else you want us to know, Alex?
Just at the end of the day, if you get a phone call from us, we're just trying to speak with you to stop the spread of COVID and get ahead of it. So if you do get that call, just please pick up.
That's Alexander Bent. He's an investigator with the Massachusetts Community Tracing Collaborative, the contact tracing team with Partners in Health. Alex, thanks for your work and thanks for spending the time with us today.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Those who got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine finally got a boost, so to speak, this week, because the company announced that a second shot of the vaccine provides 94% protection against symptomatic COVID-19 infection, bringing its numbers up to Moderna or Pfizer-level protection. They have submitted the numbers to the FDA for booster consideration. Now, this after confusing mixed messages on booster shots from the White House, then the FDA, and after Pfizer announced promising results of studies on its vaccine for children between the ages of 5 and 11. That, of course, while Massachusetts announces more than 4,000 new COVID cases over the weekend, as positivity stays at 2%. With school infections, we wonder, are things getting better? Where are we on COVID? And that means that it is time to ask the doctors, what do you need to know about timing of shots, safety in schools, preparations for colder weather? Call with those questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this week to help answer them, Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College, and Dr. Shira Daron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Landrigan, welcome back.
Sienna, nice to be with you. Thanks.
And Dr. Daron, welcome back to you, too.
Great to be back. Thank you.
So, Dr. Landrigan, this news about the Johnson & Johnson shot, according to the company and a clinical trial it ran, a second dose significantly increases protection against severe sickness and death. What do you make of the announcement?
It's good news. Obviously, anything that leads to robust, solid vaccination of more of the population is good. It'll protect the individuals who receive the booster, and it'll also contribute to slowing the spread of infection through the community.
So, Dr. Daron, I feel like over the last few weeks on Ask the Doctors, people who have received the J&J vaccine have been calling in looking for some love, looking for any attention. It's not authorized yet, a second dose. So in the meantime, what should the almost 15 million recipients of the J&J shot kind of do with this information? How should they think about it?
No, I know. It's so hard. The J&J recipients almost feel like they've been left hanging out to dry with the lack of information. I think, you know, the press release today from J&J had a couple of really important pieces of information. Not only does a boost at 2 months help, not only does a boost at 6 months really drive the antibody levels way, way up there, 12 times as high, but it also stated that the J&J recipients are not seeing the same kind of waning of immunity that the Pfizer recipients
single dose J&J recipients, you mean?
Single dose J&J recipients. And so, you know, you don't have to worry as much that things are changing for you over time. Delta does change the equation. It is more transmissible and you have to take more precautions. But you're not less protected than you were before, which is a good sign. I really hope that when the CDC's ACIP, the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices, meets tomorrow and the next day, that they address or at least give us some sense of when we can expect to hear something from them regarding their recommendation. Because there are mix and match studies ongoing where you could get a dose of a different vaccine. And, you know, this just may be a situation where we need some guidance that may be sort of outside of necessarily the FDA approval process.
Well, the calls are coming in, and we already have one on the line on the J&J vaccine. So 1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus question of Drs. Landrigan and Doron. We've got Arison on the line in Reading. Arison, go ahead. Arison.
Arison, that's right. So my whole family actually just got COVID. My husband and I, who are vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson, and then my two school-age children, who are both under 11, and one of my children is like just about to come out of quarantine on Thursday. And so we're on the tail end of it, but what I'm wondering is, with all of these, like, okay, maybe we can get a J&J booster shot, or maybe the kids can possibly get vaccinated sometime in the next couple of months. Like, where are we at right now in terms of, like, when can I get a booster shot now that I've just had COVID? And when can they get a vaccine now that they've just had COVID?
And Arison, I'm going to turn to Dr. Landrigan in a second to answer that. But while I have you, I'm going to ask, I'm noting four family members who got ill. I'm sorry to hear that. Did you all have relatively mild cases? You and your husband had already been vaccinated.
Yes, we did. We did. I mean, it felt, you know, it felt like a bad cold, I'll be honest. It felt like a bad cold. I was not happy about it. If I didn't have to quarantine, I probably would have stayed home from work. But, you know, it wasn't, like, at no point did it even occur to us, like, we should be going to the hospital or anything. You know, it was just a bad cold.
Thank you for clarifying. I appreciate that. So, Dr. Landrigan, I think the biggest part of Arison's question has to do with that time, because J&J is not approved yet for a booster, but what's the window after someone has been positive for COVID when they can get a shot?
Tiziana, let me pass that one to Dr. Doron.
Dr. Doron.
Yeah. You know, natural immunity is quite effective, at least for some time. And I almost never see cases of reinfection after infection. The exception is really very immunocompromised people. And so while the CDC says that you can get vaccinated anytime after you're no longer in isolation for your infection, and so technically once a booster is approved for your age group or for your eligibility category, you can get it anytime. But you also could ride out some of your own natural immunity and kind of extend that period, basically, of immunity. So if you waited 3 months, because reinfection is exceedingly uncommon within 3 months, if you waited 3 months from your infection and then got booster, if it was approved for you, that would be a good solid strategy that doesn't carry risk.
Thanks, Dr. Doron. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Let's pick up Miriam in Braintree. Hi, Miriam. What's your question?
Hi there. I'm having some trouble understanding the rationale behind the decision about priority at hospitals across the country that are so overcrowded. I just don't understand why unvaccinated COVID patients are the ones being prioritized, and people with other emergent needs, such as heart attacks and car accidents and whatever have you, are the ones being made to wait or not receiving care at all.
Miriam, this is assuming hospitals are turning people away.
An authoritative reason for that priority decision, and it seems to me it ought to be the other way around.
So let's get you an answer, Miriam. Thanks for that call. And Dr. Landrigan, we're going to assume, I'm assuming Miriam's talking about reports where you hear that maybe someone's been turned away from a hospital that's full. This feels like a medical ethics question. Can you help Miriam break it down?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, because I've worked in emergency rooms like most doctors, and what physicians in emergency rooms do is they prioritize, they triage, they try to take care of everybody, but resources are limited, and so you have to focus on the sickest people. I've heard those reports, too, of people in some of the southern states and western states where people with myocardial infarctions or severe trauma have had to be turned away. It's awful hard to comment on particular cases when you're not there. But I think, for the most part, doctors and nurses and ERs do the best they can with what they have. And we all wish that those people who have stubbornly refused to get vaccinated for whatever reason would please pay attention to the science and get themselves vaccinated.
Let's pick up another call here. 800-423-8255 is the number. We've got Kate on the line in Tewksbury. Kate, go ahead.
Hi. My question is about close contacts in school and there being not a need to test or quarantine if you're vaccinated, but whether or not the state actually makes that differentiation.
So, Dr. Duron, I think this comes down to the sort of test and stay approach that a lot of school districts are taking. So perhaps you can explain that and then compare and contrast that with state contact tracing guidelines, if you could, please.
Yeah, sure. I can explain test and stay. And I think the caller was actually also asking about the state's policy that a vaccinated individual is not considered a close contact for the purpose of quarantine.
Perfect.
Before anyone was vaccinated and before test and stay, a close contact was anyone that came within 6 feet of an infected person while that person was in the contagious period for at least 15 minutes, and it became 15 minutes cumulative over a 24-hour period. Now, there have been a few modifications, particularly in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the first to say that children could be within 3 feet of each other in school, and as long as they were masked, or on a bus with the windows open and masked, they were not considered a close contact. And the CDC ended up adopting that because the data were very strong that transmission was not happening in those situations. And so if we were going to put our children within 3 feet of each other in order to fit them all in the building and say that that is safe, which we did say, it made sense to also say that that wasn't a close contact. And that's working. We're not seeing any increased risk from doing that. Then you add the test stay program. So if you are within 3 feet or you're within 6 feet and don't have masks on, you're a close contact. That happens at school. And in that situation, those close contacts in school, you can keep going to school and extracurricular activities at school as long as you have an antigen Binax Now test each morning on your way in, and it's negative. And that was studied very, very carefully and a couple of times, but in a really well-done, large-scale trial in the UK, it was found to essentially add no risk over the routine sort of quarantine. Now, the question I think the caller wants to know is, but what about those close contacts that occur in people who are vaccinated? They're not considered exposed. So they neither quarantine nor do they test and stay. And yet we know that the vaccines have become less effective, both due to Delta and due to waning immunity. And I think, you know, there is a gray area there. It's the vaccines are not perfect. There will be some transmissions. But when you have highly vaccinated people interacting with highly vaccinated people or fully vaccinated people in a highly vaccinated environment, you might see some transmission, but what you don't expect to see is outbreaks that catch fire and spread, and you don't expect to see significant morbidity or mortality, so significant illness or hospitalizations. And we are going to have to get to a point where when we are well vaccinated and highly immune, we tolerate some transmission.
Thank you for that, Dr. Duron. I'm going to go back to the phones here for Mia in Salem. Mia, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. First of all, doctors, thank you so much for all of your hard work and years of studying, and thank you, WBUR, for serving the public with the news. Just wanted to say that real quick.
I am calling on behalf of a family member who's on the other side of the spectrum. He is an anti-vaxxer, anti-masker, and he keeps trying to argue something about the 28 proteins in the virus, about the spike protein is only one part of the studies and why they show natural immunity, and how it's stronger because you have the full spectrum of antibodies against all the proteins. This was just a text message that I read, and he's done surface level looking into this, whereas you guys have years and years of research on your end. So just wondering what you could say to someone like him who's asking this question.
Who would like to take that one?
This is Dr. Landry, and I can talk to that. So, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there about the vaccines, and you may have seen some of the stories, like the story in the New York Times a few weeks ago about the person in Florida who has made a business out of peddling misinformation about the vaccine, and some of the misinformation is incredibly detailed, talking about all these proteins and things. I think what people who have read this stuff have to ask themselves a couple of questions. One question to ask is when you read something about the vaccine, ask yourself, does the person who's putting out this information have anything to lose? If a licensed physician, such as Dr. Drone or myself, were to put out some unscientific information about a vaccine that ended up costing people their lives, we could lose our medical license. Have very severe consequences on us. By contrast, somebody who likes to type blogs at night has nothing to lose if it turns out the information is false. So that's one thing to bear in mind. The second thing is that people who read this stuff and get into it have to really ask themselves very personal questions. Do you want to be around next Christmas to see your grandchildren? That kind of thing. Because if you insist on not getting vaccinated, and especially if you're over the age of 55, then the risk of your getting severe illness and even dying is much higher, many times higher than the person who follows the science and gets themselves vaccinated. I realize it's not easy, especially within the family setting, to have these conversations, but these are hard conversations that people need to have.
So thank you for that, Dr. Landrigan, and that's going to give me a chance, Dr. Drone. I want to build on that to come back to you. So with what Dr. Landrigan was just saying about misinformation, we're also talking about perception of the efficacy of vaccines. You had RSN, who called in a little bit ago and said on air, my husband and I both vaccinated with J&J, and we got the coronavirus. I'm thinking also, Radio Boston producer Chris Siderick and I did a segment on the Red Sox and their COVID outbreak of 12 COVID-19 positive cases. The original case came from a vaccinated player, Kike Hernandez, and that led to some calls, including a caller we put on air last Friday saying, well, what about this vaccine efficacy thing then? If you can have an outbreak of 12 people testing positive when the zero case or the first case was a person who was vaccinated. Now, I know what the counter arguments are, but you are the one, as Dr. Landrigan said, who put in all the work and whose license is on the line. So let me have you, with great authority, answer those concerns.
Yeah, I'm talking about this a lot these days because we have a vaccine mandate for our employees here. And I've been doing one-on-one kind of counseling sessions, trying to explain to people why I believe so much in the vaccine and why I myself chose to be vaccinated. And I think, you know, there's a couple of questions we have to ask ourselves. You know, what do we want the vaccine to do for us? What was the purpose of developing the vaccine? And where do we want to be? We developed the vaccine to prevent severe disease and death and long-term consequences. And where we want to be is in a place where this virus is not gone. It's not going to be gone. We can't get there. We want to be in a place where this virus is like a common cold or flu and we can live with it. And that's what immunity will do. Widespread immunity will make it so that the virus is still circulating, but we're okay with it because we're not getting very sick from it. And so the two kind of headlines that I hear a lot that people, or the way people interpret headlines and it's wrong, are the vaccine doesn't work. You know, people are still getting infected, so why would I take it? And, you know, the CDC said that vaccinated people transmit the same as unvaccinated people. So why do you care if I'm vaccinated? And, you know, both of those are sort of slightly wrong, right? The vaccine does still work. It's not working as well as it used to. We are seeing more breakthrough cases. That's because of Delta and probably some waning immunity. But you're still way less likely to get COVID in the first place if you're vaccinated, and even more less likely to end up in the hospital or end up dying. And vaccinated people can transmit to unvaccinated people, but they're less likely to have it in the first place. And now we know that they also, although they may have a high viral load at an early point in disease, have a more rapid drop off of that viral load and a more rapid drop off of their contagiousness.
Thank you for that. So we had a tweeted question. Borakua in Boston says, I originally received J&J in March 2021, then in June with the impending Delta surge coming. Little was relayed to J&J recipients about what to do next after hearing a podcast by at Ace Lavitt, who was former Biden White House senior advisor for the COVID response, Andy Slavitt. I took it upon myself to get a Moderna booster one shot in June. What do I do now? Dr. Landergan, just briefly, any thoughts there?
It sounds to me like that person is well protected and they should get on with their life.
Okay. I love those straightforward answers, right? Get on with your life. So producer Jamie Bologna is saying, okay, should they have gotten a shot without authorization from the FDA? Was this off-label? You know, I know there are people out there. You both know there are people out there, Dr. Doron, thinking about second doses, regardless of what the FDA has to say.
I really advise people to follow what the CDC's Advisory Council on Immunization Practice recommends. Our vaccine center administers vaccines strictly according to their recommendations. They spend days talking about all of the data and deciding what is in the best interest of Americans, and I would follow that. I realize that Mr. Slavitt has made different recommendations.
And Dr. Landergan, we're expecting more from the Biden administration or the FDA in the next day or two regarding Pfizer and third doses, correct?
Yes, it looks as though probably what's going to come out is a recommendation that people over a certain age get a third dose, or people at high risk occupations, or high risk by virtue of underlying medical conditions. And so if that is indeed the recommendation that comes, as it seems to be, then let me echo what Dr. Drone said, that the people who make those recommendations have given intense thought to them, and the general public should heed them. Likewise, if it's probably a little bit ahead of things here, but if a recommendation comes down the pike in a few weeks or months, that children should, under the age of 11, should get vaccinated, if that's approved, then by all means, people should move as rapidly as possible to follow that recommendation.
And that would be, Dr. Doron, most likely the Pfizer vaccine, since it's furthest ahead in presenting data about the efficacy and safety for kids ages 5 to 11, correct?
Definitely.
All right. That was so helpful. Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, thanks so much for your help.
Thank you.
And Dr. Philip Landergan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Thanks for joining us today for Ask the Doctors.
Thank you, Tatiana. Bye-bye.
That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Patrick O'Connor. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I am Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening and calling, and do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.